You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is going out on the 10th of May, 2023. My wife and I saw a movie yesterday. It's called Nefarious. Those of you who have not heard of it, I recommend you go see it. It's low budget, but since it's only people talking, there doesn't need to be anything else. And what it comes down to is a condemned man, condemned to execution for murder. The very day of his execution, the prison calls in a psychiatrist to decide whether or not he's sane or not. And if he's insane, he can't be executed. It's sort of an odd premise because it, you know, obviously he was sane enough to be condemned in the first place. And the condemned man, your typical three names of, it's Wayne Brady, I forget the first, Edward Wayne Brady, typical serial killer name. And he's speaking to, he doesn't realize this, but the man is possessed. The demon's name is Nefarious, which is a variation of Nefarious, and he's possessing Edward's body. And, of course, the psychiatrist is very bourgeois, very arrogant, very modernist. He believes in nothing. He's an atheist. And the demon then, Edward shows up from time to time. Whoever did this, you know, did their homework as far as possession is concerned. Then a clergyman is brought in, very liberal, very modernist, who says, we don't believe in demons anymore, very much like you saw in the Exorcist many years ago. And the demon initially upset that there was a clergyman coming to see him. At the same time, the psychiatrist was there. Gets very upset, very angry, until he realizes this is a modernist. And then, of course, immediately realizes that he's no threat to him. Modernist clergy are meaningless under the best of circumstances. So in this back and forth between the psychiatrist and this demon, and slowly but surely the psychiatrist comes around, not 100%, but it turns out, of course, the very much like Christ said, you'll deny me three times, to St. Peter, this demon says you'll commit three murders before you leave here today. And, of course, it turns out that this psychiatrist had killed his mother through euthanasia, because she was getting too expensive. And you can see the guy's conscience getting to him, because the demon knows exactly what happened. And, you know, this is what your modernity is based on. You know that she didn't have to die, but it was just easier. Then he, and you know, how does this guy know this? And then his girlfriend, who I think they're breaking up, is going to get an abortion. And he says, well, that's going to be murder number two. And, of course, a psychiatrist, who obviously has a conscience, gets very defensive and very upset about this. And, in fact, he even hits the table and has to apologize for that. And the demon then goes on to explain what we've talked about many times, the Phoenician, the demon worship in Tyre and Carthage, where babies were sacrificed to Moloch in the brass bull. In other words, they were sacrificing children for the sake of enjoying more wealth and power for themselves. And clearly this person, who doesn't realize it's a demon quite yet, says, now here's murder number two. And the psychiatrist protests, saying that I'm not ready to be a father yet. In other words, you know, I'm making too much money. I'm doing too well. I don't want to be saddled with a kid. And he realizes that's exactly what he's saying. And he runs out, tries to make a phone call to stop the abortion from taking place. This guy's obviously getting into his head. And it was too late. The fact is that this demon is able to predict exactly what's going on in his life right down to the second. How could he possibly have known that the abortion is going to occur right? And in fact, he counts down. And, of course, the third murder is the fact that this Edward, not the demon, of course, is executed. He chose, this is Oklahoma, which means you can have the option of getting the electric chair. He likes the idea of torturing this poor guy in God's creation. But then, so those are the three murders, and of course, that's exactly what happens. Obviously, this guy, who the demon possesses, is very ignorant. And therefore, his body shouldn't have been fried, despite the fact that this guy has made many mistakes in his life. Not the psychiatrist, the guy who's being possessed. It started off very young, getting away with things, and being surrounded with the idea that the ego comes first. His grandmother gets him a Ouija board as a young man, and that's how demons were able to gain entrance to him. And the Ouija board exposed his sense of decision-making to the demons. They're clearly not all-powerful creatures by a long shot. And then he generalizes that, and as the psychiatrist starts, his defenses start collapsing. The demon generalizes to human history, says, you know, we were removed from our position. Lucifer is second in command. And the worst thing that could have happened to us is the fact that these flesh, mankind was created to take our place. And if you read about demonic possession, you'll see that demons get so angry at the fact that we are not almost pure spirits like demons are, being angels, that somehow flesh is raised above them. Christ took flesh and is at the right hand of the Father, meaning flesh in a glorified sense is in heaven. This is what created the hatred of the demons for humanity. So what was the point then? Once they tempted Eve, and really it comes down to power, the ego, lust, all this stuff, of course God couldn't stop it. In fact, the demon says God can't stop any of this because he wants men to love him. And if the love is coerced, then it's not worth anything. So the demon essentially, this is a lengthy, 2-hour movie. And he says our point is to efface the traces of creation in the world around us. Christ, he loves, he calls him the carpenter. He loves these meat bags, as he calls them, calls human beings. So how must he suffer when we tear one of those babies apart in the womb? They've convinced you, he's talking to Amy, we have convinced you that there is no purpose to nature. There are no, there is no real, this is just a random set of events and we can make of it what we please, and that is the ultimate insult that we can give to God. So I'm not going to get into the rest of it, but I came home and I watched a movie that I haven't seen in some time. It's not a movie, it's actually meant to be a documentary about Soviet scientist named Brukhonenko. And it's something that I've seen before. Some of you know what I'm talking about. It came out in 1940, and it's entitled Experiments to Revitalize the Organism. And it's one of the most bizarre things. If you haven't seen it, it's for free all over the place. And the point is to conquer nature and therefore to conquer death. This is absolutely essential. This is in the Stalinist era, but in both Lenin and Stalin's era, the concept was that science will completely remake and mechanize the nature around it. there is no distinction in Marxism, Soviet science, or in fact in capitalist science, between the inorganic and organic. We've talked about how artificial intelligence redefines the concept of intelligence to essentially reduce it to how a computer operates. Therefore, a computer could be human. You have to redefine, they have to redefine the term living here. And this occurred under Stalin. Stalin was pretty much obsessed with this. In Stalin's work, Dialectical Materialism, he writes, you know, he's an interesting writer, assuming that he actually wrote it all. And there's a guy by the name of J.D. Bernal from the writing in the 1920s, as well as J.B.S. Haldane, who died in 1964. These were so-called scientists in Britain, one in Britain, one in Ireland, who were Stalinists, who went back and forth from the USSR to Britain. In fact, Haldane attacked C.S. Lewis. The movie I'm talking about was based partially on The Abolition of Man, partially on The Screwtape Letters. Stalin's view, of course. Let me quote him directly. This is from his work on Leninism. New social ideas and theories arise only after the development of the material life of society has set new tasks before it. Once they've arisen, they become the most potent force that facilitates the carrying out of these new tasks set by the development of the material life of society, a force which facilitates its progress. It's precisely here that the tremendous organizing, mobilizing, and transforming value of new ideas, new theories, new political views, and new political institutions manifests itself. New social ideas and theories arise because they're necessary, because it is impossible to carry out the urgent task of development of the material life of society without the organizing, mobilizing, and transforming action. Arising out of the new tasks set by the development of the material life of society, new social ideas and theories force their way through. They become the possession of the masses, mobilizing and organizing them against the moribund forces of society, and thus facilitating the overthrow of these forces which hamper the development of the material life in society. Marxism, or Marx and Lenin, Marx and Engels straight to Lenin and Stalin, accepted the idea that it isn't so much that nature can be transformed through the process of mechanization. It is essentially a driving from the occult work of not just the Kabbalah, but certainly of Agrippa, writing in you know the first half of the 16th century. And what Stalin is getting at here, what Soviet science was getting at, is that once the entire society takes hold of the process of production, which includes the scientific establishment, we'll be able to, with greater power, concentrate this mass movement onto unlocking secrets of the natural order. You notice that twice Stalin uses the word transformative or transforming. Of course, the drive is to create a certain level of immortality. That, you know, the old society will die with the revolution. Feudalism was killed by capitalism. Capitalism is killed by socialism. But of course, the achievement of socialist society is it. It's going to change only quantitatively. There is no new society that's going to be born from it, and therefore it makes sense that science, and that is to say Soviet science, will come to understand the laws of nature such as to eliminate death. There's nothing new about this. This goes back to the alchemists and even before. In chapter 58 of the famous work by Agrippa, the three books of occult philosophy, he has several sections on eliminating death. Of course, this is many centuries ago. So this isn't something that a new society has brought about, as a Marxist would tell you. Rather, this is an ancient drive for those who have been separated from God to completely remake the order that God created, remove God from it, and then take it over, create a new order that they that puts their mark. It was like in the movie, the demon saying, this is our mark. We can't create, we can only manipulate creation. And as far as the Soviets were concerned, and Marxism even to this day, the method of replacing creation is through mechanism. Now, of course, in Agrippa's work, and especially the two small sections on immortality, he doesn't deal with mechanization, although the concept existed in terms of actual society run by machines, is nowhere to be found. But Agrippa does say that it's possible, because the Arabian philosophers agree in his words, that some men will elevate themselves above the material world of their own body. And he even says above their sensitive powers, and thus being surmounted, receive into themselves the perfection of the heavens, what he calls a divine vigor. Basing this on the idea that the soul, he says here, the soul of man is perpetual, there's no reason then that it couldn't outlive the body, and in fact, be mobilized to revive the body. He even says magicians think that perfect men may, by the powers of their soul, repair their dying bodies with other inferior souls newly separated and inspire them again. Now, that was a direct quote from chapter 58. And this is done, of course, in the Renaissance, in the very early modern period. So there's absolutely nothing new about this. And in fact, Agrippa goes back to the legends of the phoenix. And he explains in some depth and with a lot of symbolism the methods by which people have tried to achieve some variant of immortality, either practical or absolute. Ashes from the phoenix, the skin of a snake that's, you know, shed its skin, which is always a symbol for immortality. He mentions a lot of Romans, for better or for worse, including, you know, stories of the sons of Jupiter and Thalia, the myths about humans being raised from the dead. And so it's a retelling of the Christian story, just from a Gnostic point of view. The Gnostic point of view is that the mind, when it reaches a certain level of enlightenment, can then repair the creation of the evil demiurge, or Yahweh. And occult science is based on this. And Agrippa is one of the founders of the occult sciences in the Renaissance. This was the Renaissance. And he even mentions that these magicians are physicalists. They do raise dead men to life. Stinging of serpents, and he mentions the nation of the Marsi, the Sicily restored to life, and other comments that he makes in these brief chapters. Agrippa is the creation of is a creator of the occult mentality in the modern era. And Freemasonry and everything else cites him all the time. So he is the foundation, but of course he used a language that was more akin to the religious language of the time. But he does hint, if you know how to read the symbols especially, about some version of this scientific, mechanistic, and materialist approach to things. And it's hard to tell what he means by the word soul. I doubt he means it in a philosophical sense rather than in a theological sense. And he tells stories about people who have slept 196 years. He has a very primitive conception of suspended animation. And he talks about the Gnostics and everything else. So, and all the different herbs and all the different methods by which, either encoded in mythology or present to science and alchemy of the day, can revive the dead, theoretically, indefinitely. So Marx was wrong about this, and Marx didn't stress this a whole lot. This was later Marxist. Remember, the Soviet system, especially under Stalin, they had an entire mentality, an institute of control over nature. The so-called wind blockers of southern Russia attempting to you know, building this, you know, Lysenko, this grove of trees to block the wind from taking all the, blowing all of the soil away in the Caspian region. Of course, none of it worked, and they cut down the trees. And the fact that Stalin supported Lysenko, who himself supported Lamarck rather than Darwin, in other words, the doctrine that Stalin enforced, was that acquired traits can be inherited, which, of course, no one really believes today. But that was kind of a vulgar Darwinism that was enforced by the Soviet Union. And eventually he fell from grace, but you had biologists going to prison in huge numbers in the Soviet Union. And part of that was the drive that if an acquired trait, for example, being raised in Soviet society, can actually become part of your inheritance, and your children will inherit the habits of living in Soviet society. I mean, this is a simple example. Then you could create a new man far more quickly than Marx understood. But one thing that Marx, Lenin, Stalin, and Agrippa had in common was that this is nothing, this isn't anything new added to nature. This isn't a supernatural drive whatsoever. This is just the scientific establishment, whether you call them alchemists or whatever, discovering the principles behind matter that never change, and hence could be the foundation of immortality. In other words, the secret or occult, the secrets that the natural order contains, things that no one has discovered yet. And of course, given it's a new Soviet society, therefore we can discover the secrets that, and since the Soviet system, the socialist system, is going to last forever, so should its citizens. Stalin was absolutely obsessed with imposing this demonic frenzy onto the natural world. And it's one of the things that explains his hatred for the peasantry. Because if anyone was tightly connected to the rhythms of nature, it's them. And of course, being the most conservative and orthodox of the population, old believers, many of them, they had to go, knowing full well that the Americans are going to finance them anyway. So, to the movie, to the so-called documentary. I mentioned it's Professor Sergei Brukhonenko, and some of the writers, the Soviet writers I've consulted on this, actually used the phrase "as if possessed." He tried to approach the very edge of the possible in science. This is the man who put together these experiments in revitalization. Now, what it comes down to is that he created not the first device, but at least what was said, the first workable device of artificial circulation of the body. His laboratory was a freak show. I mean, there's so many dissected corpses and especially animals. And I find it interesting that he was experimenting on dogs, just like Pavlov was. There's something about the dog. The dog went into space in the Soviet system. Now, of course, Sirius is a dog star. I don't know if this is an aspect of that. And just like there are secrets of the natural world, there are secrets to science too. Everything, you know, as above, so below. So Brukhonenko, in this drive to create immortality, created what was called a fully functional heart-lung machine. The point is to supply the body with oxygenated blood. Now, he succeeded. And, you know, it might remind you of dialysis, the tools that are used in cardiac surgery. But that's not why he created this. He wasn't a cardiologist. The point was to take these isolated organs, and if you watch the movie itself, one of the first things they talk about, and Haldane actually does the English language version, is show how this system can have a heart just hanging there by itself, pump normally, or the lungs, if you blow air into it, of course, it functions just like a lung. And as far as they're concerned, this is the same thing as the organ functioning normally. The fact that it's outside of the body doesn't seem to bother them. And that's, of course, goes back to the nominalist idea that the individual is the only thing that matters. And now, some of his work ended up helping cardiac surgery, but again, that was not his purpose. Actually, it was back in 1925. He created this heart-lung apparatus. It looked like a bunch of pistons taken from an old Model T. He had automatic pumps, a reservoir for storing blood, and large tubes, the first for pumping blood, and then the other for oxygenating it. So the difference between arterial blood and venous blood. So immediately upon creating this contraption, he, like Pavlov, began experimenting on dogs, extracting their organs individually. He claimed to be able to keep them alive and functioning with the help of all of these machines. And the very fact, if the heart pumped and acted like any mechanistic pump, then it was the same thing as it being alive. But the blood was moving artificially, and the oxygen was being injected artificially. And that's the first part of the movie. You see the heart beating and the lungs going up and down. But that's not the heart of the matter here. Then they go to something unpleasant. It's a severed dog's head. And the point was that with this contraption, they can keep the head alive. They claimed that it was completely conscious. Now, allegedly, this was documented as photographs, and the film recording of this nightmare has been preserved, and actually wasn't until 1940 that the experiments to revive the organism was created. And as much as Soviet scientists were lauded for this, so was the Western establishment. The center of it is the dog's head. So it shows, you see, laboratory assistants, all female, by the way, freshly cut this head and place it on a table and quickly connect it to this system of pumps and tubes. After a while, you see its eyes move, even its tongue coming out. The head reacted. Pupils were able to constrict to the light. They put citrus fruits and other forms of acid near the eyes and the mouth and the nose so it can kind of twitch at it. Its ear allegedly reacted to a hammer striking near him. But that's not the end of it. They don't show any of this in full frame. All we see is a separate image of the hammer hitting and then the dog moving. It's not at all clear that this happens at the same time. And there's plenty of people who at the time thought this was fake. One institution that refused to think it was fake, of course, was Time Magazine, who in 1943 wrote one of the most syrupy, maudlin praises of Stalinist science using this video and claiming that, you know, they're on the verge of immortality because the Soviet scientific establishment is greater than our own. And Time Magazine has been, you know, pushing this ever since then. So then they have what they claim is reviving the dog from the dead. They pump out all the blood from a dog, goes into cardiac arrest. You see the primitive EKG, heartbeat and breathing. And they claim, it's not on the video, but they claim that it remains dead for about 10 minutes. It's then hooked up to the heart-lung machine, and it rises from death. The heart begins to beat, the eyes come back to life, and the dog just jumps up just like a normal dog, like nothing had happened to it. Now, obviously, there's a lot of skepticism to this. Some people will try to take a middle ground. Yes, it was staged. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just, there was no cameras in the room when it first happened. But the point was to show what Soviet science was going to do, and they had even Stalin's book on the achievements of the first 5 year of his 5 year plan, first 5 year plan, he cites all the Western media praising his scientific and political achievements, on and on and on. Every major capitalist paper, and he doesn't try to explain how this could be. The English translation of the video was made not too long after this, and it was shown in New York to the Soviet American Friendship Society, which was a Rockefeller financed organization to merge the two systems. Whatever, as I've said before, whatever the Soviets had at the time came from the U.S. and Britain, including its scientific establishment. But while Time magazine and a few other places just went on and on and on about how extraordinary the Soviet experiment under Stalin was, and of course never had to pay a price for this, there were some skeptics, and in fact C.S. Lewis ultimately was one of them. Now, they claim that this dog, this resuscitated dog, it isn't clear. They actually show a picture of a stopwatch taking 1 minute, not 10. But this entire establishment, I mean, the back external filtration systems had existed prior to this, but they didn't decide to put it on video. There's a lot to doubt here, but the point is clear. If this dog had a full 10 minute starvation of both oxygen and glucose, the brain should have been beyond damaged. Now, what the lab records show on the one hand and what the video shows on the other are two totally different things. The video says that the dog lived like a normal dog for the rest of its life, many, many years. But it didn't. It, in fact, lived a semi-life for just a few hours. I mean, a day at the most. And then Vladimir Demikhov continued this in the 1950s. And he is famous, of course, for the two-headed dog. And, of course, they claimed later on that this was about, you know, the creation of, like, a dialysis machine. This is about organ transplantation. Well, this had nothing to do with it. This, you know, what Demikhov did was just cut the heads off puppies, sometimes with part of the neck, but not always, and thus sewed them onto the body of a large dog. And Freud took care of the rest. And Demikhov experiments were often shown publicly, but in the same stilted way as this video does. And you see Robert Cornish in the United States, roughly around the same time. He achieved this artificial maintenance of blood circulation by injecting anticoagulants and adrenaline, and kind of rock the body back and forth to churn the blood and get it moving. And apparently it worked, and the dog was, quote, resurrected. He named all of his dogs Lazarus for obvious reasons. But for all of these dogs weren't actually alive. They were incapable of any real action. The same thing for the monkey heads being put on different bodies. The video shows not life at all, but almost a zombification. The very fact that they think that life is just the circulation of blood, and that's the only thing necessary. So this is either completely fake or the dog wasn't fully dead. And clearly, nothing really came out of this. The monkey experiments in the 1970s, Robert White, transplanting the head of one monkey onto the body of another, you know, it starts with the assumption that there is no organism here. These are just mechanical parts. The assumption in both Western and Soviet science was that the world is a mechanism. And therefore, a human-created mechanism is just as quote-unquote organic as one that nature creates. This is the demonic frenzy, as C.S. Lewis went on to discuss at great length. And, of course, the monkey experiment, the immense complexity of the nerves meant that this monkey was paralyzed. This isn't life by any stretch of the imagination. I've spoken of what the cryogenic so-called resurrection is. And it's based on a very similar principle. If the brain is frozen gradually at the point of death, so there's got to be some life in it, it can survive without damage, and then nanotechnology will take care of the rest. Now, this is from the main company's website in California. Nanotechnology is going to create essentially what is a robot zombie. But if you have redefined the concept of life, that's all life is, just the interaction of mechanical parts, well, then it is life. Obviously, it's not the same person. The fact that you can keep a brain-dead individual alive indefinitely, not really alive, he's not functioning, but the blood can be artificially pumped, air being artificially pumped into the lungs, you could claim that he's alive. It all depends on how you define the term. But this became a tremendous concern with Soviet science. Soviet science, a bit before the American version, was concerned with what could come out of this new system. Now, I mentioned J.D. Bernal. Bernal and Haldane were influential in Soviet science and vice versa. They were both Stalinists. They were both members of the party. And, of course, were both wealthy men who got whatever they wanted. Bernal wrote a very famous work, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, which has been cited. I read it a million years ago. Came out in the 20s. I think it was 29. So as the Depression begins, this is what science is concerned about. And it's not that different from Agrippa's analysis of this new mechanism. He actually says here in the chapter of Bernal's book called The Flesh, he actually says, well, again, this is 1929, modern mechanical and modern chemical discoveries have rendered both the skeletal and the metabolic functions of the body to a large extent useless. He says, an animal moves his limbs to get food, uses his bodily organs in order to return that food into blood and to keep his body alive and active. In fact, Bernal and Stalinist science at the same time spoke of how inefficient the human body is. It's so complex, and yet we can do the same kind of things with just a few moving parts. He says, in a civilized worker, the limbs are mere parasites, demanding 9/10 of the energy of the food and even a kind of blackmail in the exercise they need to prevent disease, while the bodily organs wear themselves out in supplying their requirements. Then, of course, the development, the evolutionary development of cognition, and he says, gives rise to the need of a much more complex sensory and motor organization, and even more fundamentally, for a better organized cerebral mechanism. Then he says, sooner or later, the useless parts of the body must be given more modern functions or dispensed with altogether. And in their place, we will incorporate the effective body, the mechanisms of the new functions. Surgery and biochemistry, our science is still too young to predict exactly how this would happen. Then he says, and he's going to give an account exactly of how immortality is going to be achieved in socialist and Stalinist science. He says, you should take this as a matter, rather as a fable. Obviously it's not, because he's claiming to write as a scientist here. So he's not writing a fable. What he means is the principle is true, but the precise mechanism might not be. When George Bernard Shaw saw the dog experiment, I can't tell if he's being sarcastic. He's partially humorous, partially serious. Of course, he was pro-Soviet at the time. Said, well, I want to chop my head off, because then I could read and study without having to worry about my body holding me back. The body, of course, is really a prison in the Gnostic system. But the other aspect of the Gnostic system, going back to ancient times, had nothing to do with Marxism, because both capitalism and Soviet Marxism are almost identical systems, especially today, and have the exact same priorities. It could also be fixed. if the body is just these interchangeable parts, and a head could be put on a body, and of course these days, you know, thoughts can be downloaded on a flash drive, then uploaded to the new body. Of course, they use whatever metaphor, whatever technology is dominant at the time. So much of people like Bernal, his work is still being cited today. And it's the foundation of science fiction. Now, of course, science fiction existed before 1929. But he actually cites in his claim that this mechanized revitalization of the dead, he says the experiment is not impossible. It's already been performed on a dog. And it's 3/4 of the way towards achieving it with a human subject. The point is that in the Gnostic sense, in the demonic sense, the body, just like everything else, is part of the order that God has created with the specific purposes that he has granted. If Promethean science could actually claim that this is awful, we could replace it with better bionic parts and hence live forever, then we can replace this order. We can improve on this order. Man then is superior to God. It's unclear whether God has to just not exist in their mind or just become irrelevant. And what Bernal goes through, it ended up animating, no pun intended, both Soviet and, you know, postmodern science. Delicate surgery, he talks about, to attach nerves permanently to an apparatus that could send messages to and from the brain. The brain gets connected up to a, this is 1929, to this computer system. And yet nothing ever came out of this. He says, we badly need a small sense organ for detecting wireless frequencies, eyes for infrared, ultraviolet, and x-rays, ears for supersonics, detectors of high and low temperatures, etc. He assumes that the body is a mechanism, both chemical and electrical. It's not an accident that in Mary Shelley, the primordial soup idea was prefigured. The primordial soup comes from this very same era and this very same mentality. Haldane was a big part of it. That lightning strikes this hypothetical soup, and they've created experiments where they've tried to see what this might be like, and then they hook wires up to it, and they claim that they have discovered amino acids. It's shocking how they can come into existence that quickly. And, you know, of course, they can never, this is before the discovery of RNA DNA, which, of course, blew Darwin out of the water. And now Bernal quotes Haldane. Remember, both Stalinists, both Communist Party members, talking about what the mechanization of man will look like. The very fact that both Lenin and Stalin spoke of creating one huge mechanism, that's what society is. And that's what, from Engels to Brezhnev, that's what we're talking about in the collapse of the distinction between town and country, brought about to a great extent by the mass slaughter of the peasantry. The point of the collective farm is based on this same mentality. There's nothing organic about human society. It's as mechanistic as anything else in the world. Therefore, it doesn't matter who you throw together. Of course, the collective farm system failed miserably for this very reason. They denied, and they used people like Darwin and Lysenko, and then later on, you know, the science of Haldane, and even before that with Bernal, to say, well, you know, if the mentality that says if you could just put mix and match parts like Mr. Potato Head with real people, and of course you're going to have to experiment on real people for this to happen, then the same could be used in social science. There really is no family, there is no nation, there's nothing like this. It's simply, you could throw anyone together, and so long as you motivate them somehow to work, they could do anything, so long as the party is in charge of everything. And so it's the exact same mentality, but it's called an ectogenetic factory. And this came, you know, was much a part of Lysenko science in his school in the Soviet Union as anywhere else. In fact, Bernal and supported Lysenko and his imprisoning of all of these bourgeois scientists. Haldane was a little iffier about it. Either way, no matter where you are in the modern world, Darwin is an essential figure. And so the ectogenetic factory is a pseudo-organic, even using a larval stage, so to speak, of about 60 to 120 years. And then the so-called chrysalis, the next stage, where the existing organs start being transformed and grafted onto these new mechanisms, these new motor mechanisms that they have created. And the entity would have to be re-educated how to work his new, like Darth Vader when he gets his outfit. In fact, exactly like that, how to learn how to manipulate it. Darth Vader has got to come directly out of this because he's more machine than man, but he has a human will and human frailties. But because many of his vital organs are mechanized, there's no limit to his life outside of absolute destruction of every piece of it. Now, no one says who's going to be doing this training, who's going to be subject to it, who's going to control, who's going to decide what's when it's successful and when it isn't. And then Bernal, again, heavily influential in the Soviet Union and in the West too, actually says that the very mechanism, that the method of creating these new men, I mean, literally new men, I'm not even sure you could use men, that this, the science itself will come under the control of these transformed entities. It's no accident that you see variations of this in the life of Christ, both the transfiguration, the resurrection, and then the ascension. Agrippa uses those as metaphors for his early manifestation of the theory of immortality. And then he says, of course, you know, what the body structure is going to be made out of, some rigid material, not metal, one of the new fibrous substances like plastic. And so he's talking about the creation of robots. And now, you know, many decades later, well, actually 10 decades later, the idea of cryogenics is based around nanotechnology. It's the exact same theory. It's the exact same theory, just the mechanism, which has not been improved upon, which is still obviously not organic in any way, just is now on a smaller scale. Let me go back to Stalin here. Here's what he says. Actually, it's in his The Economic Problem of Socialism in the USSR. He says, Marxism regards laws of science, whether they be laws of natural science or laws of political economy, as a reflection of objective processes which take place independently of the will of man. Man may discover these laws, get to know them, study them, reckon with them in his activities, and utilize them in the interests of society, but he cannot change or abolish them. Still less can he form or create new laws of science. Now, by the way, the article I'm getting some of these from is from J.D. Bernal, who wrote Stalin as Scientist in Modern Quarterly, Volume 8, Number 3, Summer of 1953. The concept is, or the theory is, that the scientific cognition is removed from this isolated bourgeois scientific establishment that serves its own interest to the party, subjugated to the party, and therefore, because of that, subjugated to the interests of the working class. And, you know, once the enemies of the state have been purged, the entire society. Remember, Marxism never had anything to do with equality. It rejects anything other than utility. Karl Marx viewed himself as the apogee, the pinnacle of modernism, of the Enlightenment. The word enlightenment shows up in some of these scientific doctrines all the time. And while he says, and all Marxists say the same thing, that the laws of biology and the laws of social life are identical. There is no organic or inorganic. All parts can be exchanged for every other part so long as the science is powerful enough. These laws are objective, but that doesn't mean we haven't gotten deep into them. Agrippa says the same thing in the beginning of the 16th century, that there are so many hidden powers in the elements. And of course, he defines the elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Each one is divided up into three, and the secret or the arcane or the arcana, which means, you know, deeply complicated and available only to specialists, is one of them. Now, using terms like science, you know, in the 16th century, this was written in Latin, by the way, Agrippa's work, they use symbols, and yet here in Marxism, they remove the symbols and talk about what they think the reality is. So the point, whether it be the Kabbalah, and in fact, Agrippa quotes the Kabbalists, and not necessarily in this section, but of course he's going to talk about the golem and everything else. On page, I think it's page 130, he quotes Rabbi Moises out of the Book of Galen, which Patriarcha translated, and I'm quoting here, makes mention of a man who was suffocated for 6 days and did neither eat nor drink, and his arteries became hard. And it is said in the same book that a certain man, by being filled with water, lost the pulse of his whole body, so that his heart was not perceived to move, and he lay like a dead man. And on and on and on. And that these people, all of them, have been dead for a very long period of time, were resurrected by some occult method. They'll die unless some means be used to recover them, phlebotomy or some other cure. He mentions this explicitly. Now, as I said, he connects magicians with physicalists, which makes more sense given the time period, using in slightly more symbolic language what we're talking about here. And the point of socialist science is to come to fully comprehend all the secret powers of the objective laws of nature, including how to conquer death. And Bernal really gave the foundation for not just, you know, Soviet science, because again, their scientific establishment barely existed in 1920. It had to come from the West, as their entire economy came from the West. It was as Bernal says, and I'm quoting him directly here, he's talking about Stalin, he says, but though his was the guiding hand, and all, his also the undaunted strength of purpose that all could rely on, this achievement of the Soviet Union was the achievement of hundreds of millions of men and women infused with the same determination and inspired by the same ideas. The true greatness of Stalin as a leader was his wonderful combination of a deeply scientific approach to all problems with his capacity for feeling and expressing himself in simple and direct human terms. His grasp of theory never left him without clear direction. His humanity always prevented him from becoming doctrinaire. And then he quotes Stalin as saying this. Actually, on his work, his Stalin's book on linguistics. Marxism is a science of the laws governing the development of nature and society, the science of the revolution of the oppressed and exploited masses, the science of the victory of socialism in all countries, the science of building a communist society. Marxism as science cannot stand still. It develops and improves. In its criticism, in its development, Marxism cannot but enrich itself with new experience, new knowledge. And consequently, its various formulae and conclusions cannot but change with the passage of time, cannot but be replaced by new formulae and conclusions which correspond to new historical tasks. Marxism does not recognize immutable conclusions and formulae obligatory for all epochs and periods. Marxism is the enemy of all dogmatism. And it's hard, the fact that Stalin wrote that later in his life, It's hard to swallow. I'm convinced, of course, that these men were well aware of what Stalin was doing. But if everything is just inorganic scientific laws, and there is no such thing as a soul, life is in fact just a circulation of blood and breath, chemical slash electrical impulse, then there's nothing wrong with killing them. There's nothing wrong with human experimentation, since you have there's no conception of any sense of right or natural law that might be moral. The very fact that Stalin says that there's no dogma, while in fact enforcing the most rigid dogma of any point in history, far more rigid than any religious group ever has. What he's talking about is any moral limit on the party, because the party is the manifestation of both the biological sciences, the chemical sciences, and on the one hand, and social sciences on the other. It's very, when you're throwing people in prison, when you're murdering people by the millions, it's very convenient to say that Marxism is the enemy of all dogmatism, and you, of course, very conveniently define dogmatism as these moral, the moral reaction to this kind of thing. No normal person could butcher dog after dog after dog and sew one's head on another one and pretend that it's alive in the same sense that he's still alive. And yet, since Marxism is the enemy of all dogmatism, except for Stalin's dogmas and Lysenko's dogmas, then you shouldn't be worried about it, because these are the new questions of science that a new society is going to bring about. And the party ultimately decides this. I don't have to tell you that it's, of course, identical today. You have the exact same priorities and the total politicization of science and absolute dogmatism while claiming to be against dogma. It would take me hours and hours and hours to explain how identical both advanced capitalist and Soviet socialist science and the mentality that animates both are identical. Any differences in the two systems is incidental and has more to do with geography than anything else. So much of this came from the United States. And when Pavlov, who again tortured dogs, I've spoken about him before, something about dogs, there's got to be a symbolism there. Sirius, a dog star, Dog Days of Summer. And that's perfectly okay, because science, you know, is limitless. The creation of factories to create men, and that these new transformed mechanized men will be controlling the factories at one point, and this factory will produce everything. You know, I suppose if your society is starving thanks to your own policies, creating a robot race that doesn't need food might be worthwhile. But the so-called transhumanists and everything, you know, obviously this stuff is very crude by comparison, but there's nothing specifically modern about it. We can go back to the Gnostics and, using very different terminology, talk about the same things. The foundation of it all was to be found in this movie, Nefarious. And it's done. Now, the end of the movie is iffy. It's right on the nose. There's no art to it. But that might be because this is my, and probably your, day-to-day life. We think about this every minute of every day. Depending on who's seeing this, this could be a totally new revelation. There is, you know, there's no evil in this system. Of course, there's also no good in this system. I have a very lengthy article on Marxism coming out, where people don't understand there is no morality in Marx. It's just science and facts. It isn't that it's good that the proletariat takes over the factories. It just is, because there's simply more of them. And they're the ones who are producing the value. Therefore, mathematically, at some point, social consciousness is going to catch up with the means of production and overthrow this handful of capitalists. Little did we know that those two systems are very similar. They're both oligarchies, they're both materialists. And in fact, labor in the West was overthrown by capital. Now we talked about, you know, for 2 weeks on oligarchy, that the very necessity for local production allegedly is done away with. That could be sent to the third world, and the third world can be brought here. As I've said before, when it comes to oligarchy, one of the marks is deceit. I really doubt that a lot in that video was genuine for a lot of reasons. They definitely lied about how long the animals lived. The fact that they put it on video doesn't mean anything. Stalin was infamous for pioneering new methods of messing around with photographs, including moving pictures. And it was simply, as Stalin says in another work on the press, the point of all of this is to indoctrinate the population with a new consciousness. And those who support the old consciousness will die in the same way that the old system will die, and with about the same moral blame being put on it. The fact that the Renaissance gave way to the Enlightenment is not immoral. It just is what happened. In fact, Marxism, as well as modernism, will say that that's it's perfectly consistent with dialectics. But this is how deep the Soviet mentality went. It may have been crude, but the point was to replace the order that God created with the order that the party creates. And it doesn't matter where it is. I mean, the party, well, it's the oligarchy in the West. It's the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, and there. But having a single party is a little crude because it gives a very clear target for opposition. You can parody the party. It's really hard to parody an oligarchy that doesn't really have open institutional forms yet. There's been attempts to, you know, years ago, you know, capitalism was a big fat guy in a top hat, you know, during the progressive era. But in both cases, history is driven by this tiny fanatical minority. The exact same priorities exist in the Soviet Union of the 20s, 30s, and 50s, as exists in the United States in over the last 20 years. This transhumanism and the absolute denial of humans as actual, you know, selves, that everything is based on social construction. And therefore, there is no divine order. There is no creation. It is just a random interaction that can be replaced tomorrow. There is no organic. There is no inorganic. It's all one mechanism governed by, as all these guys say here, only Lysenko, by Bernal, by Haldane and Stalin himself, by this interplay of electrical and chemical laws. Now, the very fact that nothing came out of this, that these experiments went nowhere, and no one's any closer now to achieving a very long life or mortality than it was back in the 20s, and yet the exact same metaphor of this mechanized nanotechnological entity, this zombie figure, you know, it's just a different scale, but it's the exact same mentality. Nothing has changed. But like the demon said in the movie, the point is to insult God by effacing his creation and treating his beloved human beings as simple raw material to be used and abused. Oligarchy and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union all did this, and they justified it using propaganda. And as the movie says, and the demon says to him, we've reached a point, we've desensitized you to such an extent that you don't even know what evil is if it's staring you in the face. You still don't even believe I'm a demon, yet I could predict all this stuff. It's the dumbing down morally to the point where this is this kind of determinism is the only reality that they can understand. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.